and welcome to Black Hole Cinema. Joining me from Film Scratches, Mr. Chris Wilson.
Hello there.
And joining us again, you've actually been on a few with me, it's Leslie Pitt.
Hi, how you doing? You're right.
Not too bad. Your website, www.afrofilmreviewer.com. So you can check that out. You're also on Letterboxd as well. Are you still doing regular reviews on Letterboxd?
I don't do regular reviews on Letterboxd. I think the last one I did was Bunny Lake is missing, and that was last year, or maybe earlier this year. It's annoying because Letterboxd is such a really fun site, but I just really wish they could have an app just so I can add more movies. I think that's what I kind of use it for. So,
yeah, but so obviously they go to your website then if they want to find out what you're writing. And also, we have our own website now, which is Black Hole Online, but you can go to that. We haven't got a proper address yet. It's still on WordPress, so it's blackholeonline.wordpress.com. And we've got reviews, features, and articles on there from myself, from Emma, from Tony, and some from guest writers as well. Those have mostly been on the podcast previously, but there's also some that haven't as well, so you can check that out. You can also obviously check us out on the Twitter as well. We're going to delve into some film news first off before we get onto our reviews, and the one story that I couldn't not mention was apparently that James Bond is going onto Broadway. I know Tony wasn't overly impressed with that news, but apparently it's taking to the stage and it's currently being put together and produced and looking like it will run late 2017 to early 2018. Firstly, how can they do it on Broadway when obviously it's about an English person? Surely it should be opening in the West End rather than Broadway. But do you think it's going to be any good? I can't see how it's going to work, personally.
No. Yeah, I'm looking forward to see what sort of songs they come up with.
I'm not the biggest Bond fan.
Yeah.
But something like that, I don't know. I think it's just seeing what money you can get out of something, really, isn't it, more than anything else?
Exactly. I can't imagine that generally a James Bond fan is going to be, you know, much of a musical enthusiast, so they're probably not the first people that are going to go and watch a musical anyway, so I'm not quite sure where they're going to get an audience for that from.
Maybe if a single of the songs in it, Sean Connery's accent, maybe that'll do it for them.
Yeah. Or maybe they won't even bother writing any songs, they'll just use Diamonds Is Forever, etc.
Oh god, no, I've just thought that's what we're going to do. We're going to take all the different theme songs from over the years and somehow incorporate that
into a story.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrible. Especially when we got to Die Another Day. Oh, Christ.
And did you have some news as well, guys?
For me, I've been in a state of melancholy. I think I've been very frustrated with recent news as of late. Not so much anything like a specific film, more in the sense of how the creative classes are being kind of treated. We had Nicky Morgan attacking Arts and Humanities and saying that it limits your options if you pick them as university subjects. Mm. We've had the constant throttling of the BBC in the last week and a half, you know, from people who claim of a left-wing bias, who, you know, usually write for right-leaning newspapers. One of the worst things I find for me in my day as a film watcher is the Dissolve has actually dissolved. Mm. It came quite out of the blue. I've been reading, there's a really, really good article about it in Critic Wire with Keith Phipps, and it was just a bit of a shock for me, mostly because I'm a massive fan of it. I'm a big fan of their Movie of the Week articles, and I was a massive fan of the feature Forgotbusters. And Forgotbusters was this thing on where Nathan Rabin would look at films that had made a ton of money, but no one talks about anymore. And I think, you know, just little things like that that they did that I found quite interesting. And the upsetting thing for me about the whole thing is I just get the feeling that in terms of creatively, we're getting royally shafted everywhere, left, right and centre. It just feels that we are now moving into a stage, especially with something like Jurassic World making as much money as it has, that, you know, the bottom line is, you know, is the profit margin, and that's the only thing that matters. Quality of work doesn't matter in any shape or form. And that's what we'll get. That's what we'll soon see if the Tories get their way with the BBC, if Nicky Morgan gets her way with, you know, shutting down Arts and Humanities. And I think that's what we're going to see in terms of film writing as well. Things like The Dissolve, which was a fantastic middle ground balance of art and mainstream, disappear. And I've already been tired of so many of English, for that matter, who don't really do too much. They're very good with the rumours and jumping on ship in the same way as like the Slash Filmcast websites or anything like that. They're very good imitating American sites, but they're not very strong in the same way as something like The Dissolve. And I think that's, for me, really important to have something like that. I think we're only really having Sight and Sound, and, you know, very soon I think they'll get throttled soon as well with what they need to do, because obviously the Film Council stuff has been kind of dumped on the BFI, and it can only spread so thinly. But I don't know. I say melancholy. I'm just damn right angry more than anything else.
I think it's sort of an interesting state that we're in, especially with film criticism, where something like The Dissolve can't stay afloat. And I don't know. I've sort of disillusioned a bit about how film writing is becoming more about PR, and I sort of don't like that. I think there's plenty of room for like looking at film in an artistic way, you know, from a storyteller's way. But recently, especially, you know, when you see some so-called film critics, you know, going on about, you know, San Diego Comic Con, and I'm just talking like fanboys, there's sort of, I think film criticism is sort of dumbing down quite a lot, and I don't like it.
How do you think this is going to directly affect, you know, the films that are coming out? You kind of obviously mentioned that a lot, you know, recent successes of you know, old work, as it were, coming back out and not particularly being done well. You know, Terminator probably being the most recent example of that. Do you think that's going to be a trend, that it is going to affect the quality of what we get?
To a point, it sounds in a really roundabout way. I think one of the things when stuff such as The Dissolve disappears and whatnot, is you are not alerted to smaller works.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that kind of upsets me now, especially on the internet, is we have such a binary way of thinking. I will never, you know, I won't poo-poo anyone's love of certain films, so to speak. But I find it very annoying that we now only really look at film as I like it, I dislike it. We don't look at any other readings in any shape or form. I mean, just look at how I loved Mad Max. I thought Mad Max was really fun, but it seemed like the feminist readings of it were very limited, because she was a kick-ass, you know, because Charlize Theron was just another kick-ass, you know, feminist story. I think there's much more to that, and I think should have been interesting if more people were kind of bringing up on that. But no, I think what happened was very just straight down the line. I think people are following too many trends. And going back to what you said, Chris, I think it's right in the sense of just stuff kind of being dumbed down and just kind of being, you know, that's the only thing we see. Like, I didn't really mention too much before we started recording, but, like, you know, I wasn't able to see Love and Mercy this week, which kind of just slipped under the radar for most people. I only saw trailers, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and I've got two cinemas and neither of them are playing it. That's 8 screens in one, 12 in the other. But of course you get more Jurassic Park, Jurassic World, everything, and we're in a state which I call like a callback culture. All these films we seem to be watching Terminator, and that is just, you remember this film from before, here it is. And, you know, there's so many fans who just seem to be very sort of, yeah, I liked it. I remember it from nostalgia, so therefore it's fine. I don't know. I just want stronger readings, and I want different films. But I I'm old before my time. I'm very get off my lawn at the moment. So I find it very worrying that we can't. One of the things that I find so important about things like the Dissolve was it had the best comments board, where people didn't go to just attack the writer or attack other people in the comments. It wasn't like a YouTube comment page or anything else like that. It was they actually had interesting conversations about what was being said, and we've lost that. And now, you know, and I'm seeing it a lot more on Twitter, people just jumping into conversations just to try and force their opinions on other people and not really having any nuance or balance. And I do think that kind of, I do think it kind of matters. I think it's in a roundabout way, but I think you kind of need, you know, people who are looking at things in a very thoughtful way, but wrote very well and very, and in a very approachable way as well with that. That, you know, they weren't as dry as some a certain sound can be, but they weren't as hyped up and, you know, as some of our kind of other media is. I don't want to name any names because I do read some of them. You know, I do read some of them from time to time. I think it's kind of important. It will be something like the Dissolve that will turn around and talk to you, to, you know, alert people to stuff like Dear White People. It's not really going to be Empire. It's not really going to be Total Film. They will do a quick review and that will be it. You know, these guys were actually looking into those things and kind of, you know, you having that sort of debate.
It gets buried as well, particularly on their websites, that those reviews get buried under the weight of everything else that they've got going on. And as you said, they might have a tiny little review in the corner of one of their magazines, but it's not going to be, you know, their front page. It's not going to be their, you know, double page spread in the centre. It's never going to be like that. And you mentioned Love and Mercy not showing anywhere. Again, I'm the same. I'm surrounded by cinemas. You know, in the West Country, there's not an abundance of art house cinemas, but we've got a few of them around. And I'm quite blessed that I can get from city to city and to different towns quite easily. And it's just, it's strange that none of them are showing it. You know, as you, I've got a 9-screen in 30 minutes one way in Taunton. I've got, I think it's 5 screens in Exeter. They've got a 5-screener, they've got a 2-screener, and they've got a 3 or 4 screener. And again, it's not showing in any of those, in any of those locations. And it's not even like it's been a busy film week, really. Ted 2, which we'll review shortly, is kind of the big release, but it's not like, and that there has been an abundance of other releases, you know, whereas, you know, a few weeks prior we had Pitch Perfect 2 and Mad Max released both on the same week. So in that respect, you can understand why smaller pictures perhaps might get lost, you know, alongside those. But it's not like there have been many other big releases this week. You know, obviously last week we had Minions and the week and Terminator, and the week before we had, or a few weeks ago we had Jurassic World. But even then, Jurassic World's been showing, you know, it's in its fifth weekend, the weekend, this weekend. So it seems strange that something like Love and Mercy is just not getting any playtime. Obviously, can't not mention Comic-Con. Mostly it's the DC trailers that have been exciting people. The Batman versus Superman trailer, as well as the Suicide Squad. Anything else?
The one thing I picked up from the Batman Superman trailer was how long it was, considering how, it's not even out for another, what, 8 months, 9 months?
Yeah.
And I think it's desperation on their part. I think they want to try and get as many people in as possible, because to them, I think they need to break that billion the dollar worldwide figure. Otherwise, all the other plans are going to fall apart, I think. They're desperate for Marvel money, and I think this is why we're seeing so much so soon.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a great trailer. I really enjoyed it as a trailer. And I think what they need to do, I think you are right there. But I think what they're planning to do there is trying to kind of, you know, quell all the worries about all the choices that they're making. I think the big thing is when everyone came out of Man of Steel, it's like, Superman doesn't do that. Why is there so much destruction? Why was he doing this? And I think one of the things that Snyder's doing quite well is trying to answer the questions that are coming up. I love that image. I mean, I know it brings up again kind of 9/11 imagery. And I know it kind of, you know, that seems to be the thing, that one of the go-to things for a lot of big budget filmmakers. But the idea of just seeing Bruce Wayne just run into the smoke, it's an effective moment.
Yeah, I like how we got a double whammy in there, because if you notice, they did a Hurricane Katrina of it as well.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I'm surprised they've not got a couple more of these things in there as well. You know, why don't we just like show a shooting on a beach or something while we're at it?
Was that strictly definitely what that scene was? Or was it potentially in...
What, the Katrina thing?
No, the obviously what looked like him running into kind of 9/11, or was it potentially...
It looked like, especially from the angle it was shot in Orvalo, it looked like the footage that someone got from lower up on the day of 9/11 of a plane crashing into the World Trade Center. It was almost a like shot. It's
right.
It'd sort of be distasteful if they hadn't already done it about 50 times since then.
And obviously, we should probably mention the death of Omar Sharif. For me, probably most famous for Lawrence of Arabia. That's kind of the one that I kind of remember him from. What about you guys?
Yeah, the same here.
Over 100 acting credits to his name, and there is apparently a short film that was in post-production that was due to be released later this year. So I imagine that still will be. It's an animated short, so I wonder how we'll get to see that. I'm sure it'll probably now. Actually, it's always a bit sad, but probably will get more publicity now than it would have if he'd not died. It's a bit like the case with the Robin Williams films that have kind of come out. They're now getting more fanfare than perhaps they ever would have done previously. Any of his other films come to your mind?
Well, no, I know a lot of people were really into him in Top Secret, and really enjoyed him in that. Obviously, he had Dr. Zhivago as well, which, you know, a big thing. My David Lean isn't too great, but I, you know, one thing I, you know, I'll always remember from Sharif is obviously his appearance and his entrance in Lawrence of Arabia. It's such a memorable scene and shot from a film that has so many memorable shots, and it was on it was on just before we started recording, so I had it on in the background so much, and it's just an amazing film to watch, just beautiful in from moment to moment. I think he really captures something in there. He's got such a commanding presence, and you know, only to be kind of matched by Peter O'Toole and Alec Guinness all in the same film. And I think one of the things that's starting to upset me now is the fact that all of those guys are no longer with us. It's a bit like with like Christopher Lee recently as well. You're kind of noticing all these guys kind of disappearing, and even if you weren't kind of hooked up in their films or anything else like that, you knew who they were. Absolutely. As film fans and their place, and it just, I don't know, for me, I get kind of I worry about my own mortality when that happens, because the people that you consider heroes and landmarks just start to leave. So I don't know. That's just me though.
Absolutely. So if you sitting not doing anything when you're listening to this, or after you listen to this, obviously, then why not pop on one of his films, Lawrence of Arabia? As I said, probably the most poignant one for me. Up next, our review of Ted 2.
Happily ever after only exists in fairy tales. Yet a talking teddy bear is about to marry his girlfriend.
I now pronounce you teddy bear and wife. May kiss the bear.
Proving that Americans don't give a crap about anything.
So I got some big news.
Tammy Lynn and I are gonna have a baby.
That's awesome! Wait, how do you guys...
We need a sperm donor.
What is that? What are you doing?
Getting ready, dude.
What do you mean getting ready? What are you doing with your hand?
I'm doing this for you. So when I get in there, I can just bust it out.
What, you think you are, Red Lobster?
Hey, Johnny, you did it!
Right here, buddy.
Catch!
What the...
Dude, that's somebody's kid!
Fight the shit!
Oh, wait, wait, wait. I'm going to take a picture and post it on Facebook.
What?
Hashtag Grr Monday.
Help me!
So Ted 2 picks up but a few years, I think, after the first one, where Ted and his human girlfriend, Tammy Lynn, have decided to get married, and it kind of then leads to them wanting a child. Being a teddy bear, obviously, it's not going to be simple for them to achieve that, and they end up having to try and to adopt, which then basically flags up the fact that actually he's not a human being at all in the eyes of the American government, and it causes some issues, and they have to go to the help of lawyers played by Amanda Seyfried, as well later on Morgan Freeman as well, and Mark Wahlberg as John is also along for the ride as well. It's had some criticism perhaps being a bit light. What did you guys think of it?
To be honest, I didn't mind some of the comedy elements in it, but it is notably, it's reverted to Family Guy humour, as in all the jokes are in the cutaways now, and there's the actual main plot, which isn't very good, and it is pointed out to me that if you, I'm not sure if you two have ever watched Family Guy. I mean, I stopped watching it years and years ago. But it's the exact plot from season one where Brian goes through the same thing. They're basically taking the same plot and turning it into a film. And there was barely enough plot for 22 minutes, never mind 2 hours.
No. I did think about, it must have been halfway through it, I checked my watch and, you know, that's a big no-no. And I thought, this was nearly over. I thought when they were in the, it was after the first court case. I thought, oh, that's it, we're nearly done then, that's good.
it's really bizarre because then, you know, the whole thing with Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
And then they have the road trip and then they go to Comic Con and it does seem to really start to drag after a while.
Mm.
And then they have this added on plot where they bring back Donnie, even though it was by far the worst thing in the first one. It was just like, it felt unnecessary in the first film without, and, you know, that was the main plot without bringing him back again.
Yeah.
And the film itself, it's funny, and, you know, there's one scene, another cutaway gag is not actually anything to do with the plot, where they go to an improv comedy club and like shout out suggestions. You know, that was the funniest scene, but it's probably worth seeing it just that alone. But other than that, it's a comedy sequel. That's all you can say, really.
It's definitely the case where all the actual funniest gags were pretty much in the trailer, though, as well. I found,
yes,
you know, going into it, I thought, I'm quite looking forward to this. You know, the trailer looked funny, but, you know, the plot looks weak, but, you know, I'm sure if the humour holds up, it'll be all right. But I just didn't laugh as much as I thought I would. Well, I laughed quite a bit in the first one, and I did enjoy the first film. But the other thing that stuck out to me is Amanda Seyfried is no Mila Kunis.
No, I find it really, I found the film really odd, quite uneven, and a little bit frustrating. I think one thing that annoyed me so much is you see this opening where it's a really, really lovely kind of opening to, that reminds me that Seth MacFarlane is a kind of song and dance man, and he does have a real affinity and love for old Hollywood. He said, you know, you see it in Family Guy sometimes, and, you know, the love of musicals and whatnot. And I would really like him to kind of lean on that a lot more. But unfortunately, what happens is he kind of loses it slightly. There's some really funny things. But if you don't really have a working knowledge of American pop culture, the jokes seem to fall flat.
Yeah.
The amount of times that people were there was jokes about stuff from, like Tyler Perry, and it's, you know, that for me, okay, yeah, I get it, but it fell completely flat to an audience that I've never seen a Tyler Perry film, mostly because in terms of distribution, he doesn't come out in England. No. So you know, it doesn't seem to be
you,
as...
You went Tom Brady and Jay Leno as well. Like, yeah. I was the only person that laughed at the Jay Leno joke because I knew who he was. But I'm assuming that all the other people around me, which obviously were generally people that were younger than me, you know, they were probably between the ages of kind of like, you know, 16 and you know, 21 probably was the kind of core audience. But they had no idea who he was. They didn't have any idea who Tom Brady was either. You know, even though they kind of made it completely clear who he was. But also, I thought the Liam Neeson cameo was bizarre as well.
In all fairness, with the Liam Neeson one, they sort of ease an English audience into knowing what tricks are, blah, blah, blah. But it's still awkward, and you're like, why is this here? It's like this meta gag about Liam Neeson, and they've just turned him into he turned himself into a joke a while ago, but. It's just like a whole thing at the expense of his former persona.
Yeah. I thought John Slattery was wasted as well. I love him in Mad Men, and it's definitely the kind of role that he's great at. But he was in it for, like, what, 10 minutes, and he spent most of the time sitting in the background.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I found it to be such an odd film. Like yourselves, I had an issue with the pacing of it throughout, but I think one of the things that kind of frustrated me was just how McFarlane was very quick to just go on jokes on race constantly. The whole Black Cock thing and all this other stuff that was going, and I'm a fan of Family Guy. I don't mind Family Guy. I really enjoy American Dad, so this isn't really me having a go, but I just found him so quick to go on these gags. And also in a plot that is about civil rights. And I just found that really awkward. I found it really jarring, mostly because the amount of lip service he gives Dennis Haber, the amount of lip service he gives Morgan Freeman. There was there was like four black actors in there, which is more than most films these days. But, you know, he doesn't give them really prominent roles and prominent parts. There's lots of jokes kind of at the expense of minorities. And I don't think he does it well enough. Not to say that you can't joke about race. That's not what I'm trying to say. I think he does it better. I think he does it way better in American Dad and Family Guy than he does on the big screen. I think he has a big problem with, you know, how you say, Chris, it feels like a Family Guy episode. And I don't think his humour translates that well onto live-action film. I think cartoons give him a little bit more leeway and a little bit more wiggle room to do what he does. And I think he's a bit more cutting when everything's kind of chopped down. When he's got a film, I think he's quite rambling and ambling. And this is from someone who really enjoyed the first Ted. I really enjoyed the first Ted. I laughed a lot, but this one I just found myself going, I just found the jokes just poor choices, and I found them more hit misses than hits.
The thing I found weird as well, and my friend who I went to see this with pointed this out, but with some of the cutaway gags as well, which, you know, are completely unnecessary, but that's where all the comedy is. If there's like one bit where they destroy his laptop and, you know, they go over the top, and in Family Guy, you think, yeah, that's fine. But then you think, this probably took you like a whole day to shoot this like scene. It's like a bit where they go scuba diving to destroy this laptop. I'm like, you probably spent the whole day to get 5 seconds of film. And it's just weird how they concentrate on that, and whereas like the main plot doesn't work.
No. On one of our regular features on the site in Director's Corner, which is one of Tony's, he mentions that potentially Seth MacFarlane's time on the big screen is potentially running out. Do you think he'll be scuttling back to the small screen, or is he going to be given a few more cracks of the whip?
I think he'll be given a few more cracks. I think, in all fairness, these films don't cost that much to make, and I think he's making so much money for Fox. With Family Guy anyway, I think he'll probably get it in any future contract. He'll get to continue making his own comedy films.
I think there is a talent there, and I think it's kind of being wasted on really simple gags. And I think, you know, I think my biggest problem with Seth in this film, as opposed to anything else, was it was very sort of, look, don't worry, guys, I'm liberal. Look at how liberal, look at all my liberal friends are in this film. This gives me carte blanche to do all this stuff. And I was like, well, yeah, but you're not particularly very cutting. You're not very insightful. I think there could have been a really good comedy about the idea of a talking bear fighting for civil rights and justice. And basically what really happens is all he's really done is just put a really good Jurassic Park reference in there. It's just callback culture again. The only reason this film seems to exist is because the first film made money.
Yeah. You mentioned, obviously, that the Donnie plotline is pointless. I don't like the character, first and foremost. I find him quite irritating. But also, again, it just felt pointless and kind of strapped on to the end of the plot to kind of give them just another hurdle to kind of overcome. When actually, had they actually concentrated more on, you know, the court case and the actual civil rights path that obviously the character was going on, perhaps it would have been more successful. And there potentially was more room for comedy in there, because it kind of, the Donnie stuff just became a bit slapstick.
I don't know. Slapstick's his thing, and it goes back to the fact that he does have a love of these older style of humour and Hollywood. But I just don't think it works very well. I think his timing seems to be incredibly off in this. And I think it was the same thing with what was the Westerly did?
A
million jokes to West.
Yeah, I was trying to think it's funny. A million ways to murder a film.
And once again, I don't think it was as bad as people said, but I just think that everything's a little bit just off. It doesn't seem to hit home very well, and I don't know what that is. I think, you know, you've got someone like Mark Wahlberg who has shown his comic chops so many times. And I was like, you know, there's nothing as good, as interesting as when he was reading off the names before in the first film. I mean, they try it again here, but not to the same effect. And I think the problem is it's just how crass can we be? It's one of these things, it's the argument that's going on now with so many people is, are you doing a decent joke? Or are you just being crass for the sake of being crass? And by being crass and being offensive, are you trying to hide behind a joke and going, oh, it's just a joke, don't take it so seriously? You know, it's like lads banter, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where people are just kind of being insulting and going, oh, yeah, it's just banter. When, you know, it's like, well, what? And I don't know. I'm sounding a bit like a Mary Whitehouse here. And I'm not, because obviously I'm a fan of his stuff. But I think just something is off. I think he is going for the cheaper gags, and I don't think they're coming off as well. I think there's a certain amount of oversaturation with McFarlane, and I think the Cleveland show kind of showed that. And I think the film Ted was just at the right time, and I think it was kind of perfect to make the money. But I think once a Million Ways to Die in the West, his Oscar stuff, I don't think it's hitting home as much anymore. And I think the world has changed even in the last 3 years since Ted. I think it's kind of really important to see that the world has kind of changed. And I think not everyone really thinks that a Saturday Night Live gag about a woman on a period is very funny.
Right.
Because ultimately that's all it is. It wasn't skewering anything or anything else like that. It was just someone basically doing a period joke. Just say, oh, look, I'm a woman, I'm on my period. Aren't we all irrational and stupid because of it? And I'm like, oh, wow. Is that where we're going with this?
The decision not to involve Mila Kunis in this one, apparently she was up for doing it and she was available and stuff. So was it a bit bizarre for them to make that choice, for them to split that couple up?
Just... I thought she'd fallen pregnant, which is why she'd been written out.
Well, I know she was pregnant, but obviously she's had the baby, isn't she now? But I don't think she was pregnant at the time of this filming, or potentially she was, but she wouldn't have been very far along, I wouldn't imagine, because this probably would have been filmed sometime last year. And I think she had the child sometime this year, so she'd have been very early in her pregnancy. But I don't know. It just seems bizarre not to involve her when she was arguably one of the stronger points in the first film. And obviously they've got such a good working relationship.
Yeah, I think they probably wrote it out, otherwise Mark Wahlberg wouldn't have had anything to do otherwise in the film.
Yeah.
It's as if they needed to give him another love interest so he had something to do.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's the only thing I can think of.
Mm. Yeah, Amanda is kind of wasted.
Yes.
In this, and once again, now I'm just going to be nitpicky, but it's kind of annoying at the idea of we're seeing a character that doesn't know pop culture, and you know, is kind of blind to pop culture, and then reels off like literary names, and then doesn't know who Gollum is.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of silly.
Yeah, it is a bit bizarre. And the first time that joke that kind of was used, it was funny and it made sense. But for them to keep doing it and for her literally to know nothing about what just seemed a little bit ridiculous for this incredibly intelligent woman, you know, who was, you know, a young lawyer, not to know, you know, some basic pop culture references, did seem to fall flat somewhat, I thought.
But it's done better in The Other Guys. That's what annoys me. I've seen it be done. The idea of having Michael Keaton just say TLC songs all the time and everyone trying to pick him up on it, and he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I think it's done far better and it's funnier, and it's much more, it's far better integrated into The Other Guys, which of course is another Mark Wahlberg film, than it is here. And that I think is quite interesting. You know, I watched The Other Guys again recently, and you realise this is a film that was that made some really odd but telling, you know, commentary about capitalism, especially at the end, and excess. And I thought that actually, I think it worked in favour. This is talking about civil rights, but it's just trying to use civil rights as a ploy in order to make as many crash jokes as possible. And I'm like, he's not Trey Parker, he's not Matt Stone.
No. It'll no doubt take money, though. You know, there will be people going to see it. It's actually been a very successful year.
The box office opening at the moment is 125 mil, based on a 85 mil budget.
Yeah, so not too bad. Before we move on to the next review at Love and Mercy, we'll take a quick look at last weekend's box office top 10 here in the UK. At number 10 in its second week is Knock Knock. I've got to be honest, I hold my hands up. I have no idea what the film even is. I've heard of it.
That's the Eli Roth, Keanu Reeves team up that we all wanted.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. Number 9, it's fallen down quite substantially in its third week. It's Mr. Holmes. Still took over 100,000, as I said, in its third week, but down quite substantially. Number 8 is one of the Royal Opera House streams, which is... I've got to try and pronounce it. Guillaume Tell, something like that. Yeah, there we go. That's taken quite a fair bit of money for one of these event cinema streams. Actually took more than Mr. Holmes, obviously. 114,000, quite a lot of money. And still sticking around is The Empire Strikes Back, which Tony and I mentioned several weeks ago now. The fact that it's being re-released, as it were. Is it in the secret cinema? I can't remember.
It is,
Yeah. So, and that's, for that reason, it's being allowed to qualify for the box office top 10, even though it's a bit cheeky, really.
apparently, it's like sold out, so it'll be like number 7 all summer, because it's sold out all its ticket allocation already. So
yeah. Number 6 is the Melissa McCarthy comedy Spy, which has taken 9 million to date in its fifth week. And I've got to say, I bloody love Spy. I thought it was really good. I went in quite low expectations, but it just Jason Statham made the film worth watching. It was brilliant. Mm. Number five, first proper new release of the week, or of last week, rather. Tony reviewed it on the website. It's Amy. Took £500,000 in its first week. Supposed to be very touching. Have you seen that one, Chris?
No, I haven't.
No. So that's one film we haven't seen. Go watch that one. There we go.
Yeah, very good.
Number four is Magic Mike XXL, which I'm sure you've seen.
Oh, yeah, you know.
$1.5 million in its first week last weekend. No doubt will secure more outings for Channing Tatum with his top off. Number three, it's taken an astronomical amount of money. It still took over $2.5 million in its fourth weekend. Jurassic World, obviously dropping down from number two. At number two, its new release is Terminator Genesis. What did you guys think of that one?
It's awful. From the badly spelt title to the fact that the plot doesn't really make sense to the fact that the best part of the film is where it's just in the original film. I had a really hard time with this. I found it quite dull. I found the action sequence quite, limp-wristed, even though relatively well executed. I really couldn't stand the plotting and how it was put together, and it just reminded me of why I haven't really been to the cinema this summer. Nearly every film I've seen this summer, in terms of since the Avengers, I just haven't really hit the mark for me. And I think one of the reasons is it's just this callback culture. I don't think nostalgia is good enough for me to have to pay for another thing of just this stuff. I'm not a big fan of this good enough culture that we're having, and where because you know of the films before, that's good enough and that's all you really need. I find it really frustrating. I find it really awkward and annoying and cloying, and just the hideous. I don't understand Jai Courtney.
About to say, what the fuck is that? Jai Courtney, I don't know, people keep bloody casting him. First it was A Good Day to Die Hard, and then it was this, and he's also in Suicide Squad, and he's in a number of other bloody awful films, yet somehow he's still getting work.
I find him charmless, and and this is no disrespect to him as a person, as if I were ever going to meet him. But but I just find I do not get on with him on screen. It's just a very bland presence, and I think that's something. I think that's a big problem. It was very interesting seeing him go up against Schwarzenegger, because Schwarzenegger was never the best actor.
Yeah.
But one of the things that made him so interesting was his presence. He has such a good presence about himself, even though he was never the greatest actor.
No.
And I'm finding that missing out of all the action guys that we're seeing recently. I think it's really, really interesting, and I think a really good thing that someone like Chris Hemsworth has signed to Ghostbusters and Vacation, even though, once again, we're talking about callback culture. But I think the fact of putting his choices in there is showing that he's got a little bit of charm and presence elsewhere. And I think he's very good at kind of showing that. Couldn't stand it. Really couldn't stand it.
So Terminator Genesis probably will be slipping very quickly down the box office in the next few weeks. It took just under $4 million in the UK in its first week, and I very much doubt it took even half that this week. But no surprises, number one is Minions in week two, taking nearly $6.5 million last weekend alone. So far, $21 million to date, and I'm sure that will have gone up and up this weekend as well, because it was very busy for that one. So that's the box office top 10. Ted 2 will probably slip in there somewhere, but our next review, Love and Mercy, probably won't be so lucky.
Excuse me. Oh. Can I help you today?
I'd like to buy a car.
Hi, I'm Dr. Eugene Landy.
Do you know what this man is? Brian Wilson.
of the Beach Boys.
Ah. Round, round, get around. I get around. Yeah, get around, round, round.
We've all grew up in California. The brothers here, Dennis, Brian, and Carl.
So I listen to those harmonies. I would teach them to my brothers, and we'd all sing. Listen to me, I'm going on and on. What about you, Melinda? Why don't you have a boyfriend?
He broke my heart.
You shouldn't have done that.
In the 1960s, Beach Boys leader Brian Wilson struggles with emerging psychosis as he attempts to craft his avant-garde pop masterpiece. In the 1980s, he is a broken, confused man under the 24-hour watch of shady therapist Dr. Eugene Lundy. What did you think?
Well, I'm the only one that's seen it. I go for it. Yeah, I did get lucky going back to the point earlier on. I have to be in Sheffield this weekend because I live in Grimsby, Hawaii, so we have one cinema in about 20-mile radius, so I got very lucky. It's a film of two halves. Literally, you've got the two different stories going on. And personally speaking, I'm like a big Beach Boys fan, and I know about this story because I've read all about it. When Brian Wilson finally released Smile, this was like back in 2004, it happened. So I already know all the details. And what surprised me about the film is I thought the latter-day stuff would be more interesting to me, because this was after he'd gone to the bed for literally 3 years. And then this Eugene Lundy guy, he shows up, he helps him get back on the straight and narrow a bit. But it turns out he's got him misdiagnosed as a paranoid schizophreniac. You know, he's got him absolutely pilled up and is basically trying to get him to write music, write an autobiography, and like put all of his estate into his name. You know, he's just basically exploiting him. So I thought that would be the most interesting bit. And, it's a good performance by John Cusack, who plays the latter day Brian Wilson. But in the end, I was far more gripped by the early stuff where he's still in the Beach Boys, but he decides after a particularly a bad tour where he has a panic attack on a plane, he decides to stay home and record what would become Pet Sounds, which, if you know anything about history of pop music, it's like one of the biggest albums. You know, it's what Paul McCartney considers to be the greatest album of all time. And you're just getting to watch this process, this like a meticulous creativity he has, and like all these wonderful ideas, basically creating like an early version of chamber pop, you know, with like French horns and sleigh bells and all this lot. And while it isn't as dramatic, even though they do include this stuff like his famously bad relationship with his father, who was the Beach Boys' manager until Brian sacked him. We've got stuff like that in there, but for the most part, apart from his quick fall from grace towards the end after Pet Sounds flops commercially, and he starts, through drug use and through other reasons, he starts having auditory hallucinations. You know, he starts hearing like really creepy sounds. But the earlier stuff is a lot more interesting. It helps that Paul Dano, who plays him, is fantastic in the role. I'll be honest, apparently he's been in a bunch of stuff that I've seen, but I never actually realised it was him. Once it was explained to me, oh yeah, he was also in this and that, and apparently he's in Little Sunshine as well.
12 Years a Slave.
And 12 Years a Slave, And I'm surprised he's not a bigger actor than what he is, just based on this one performance alone. You know, this is the sort of stuff where if Love and Mercy evidently isn't being swept under the carpet, you know, this is the sort of thing you get nominated for. So it's a bit of a shame in that regard. And like I said, it is the early stuff more interesting for the later day stuff. The later day stuff, even though that's how it turns out in real life, it becomes a love conquers all type story. And I think because the sort of swinging between the two, it just becomes a standard music biopic. It reminded me of Get On Up, that came out recently, the James Brown biopic, whereas the story is really interesting, but unfortunately it's just hard to convert that into a really interesting film without taking away some of the detail, the dramatic effects. They sort of have to put everything in there, and as a result it gets a bit baggy, which is a shame, but other than that, I do recommend the film. It's very nicely told. It's a fascinating story anyway, but just particularly to see the early stuff with Creation of Pet Sounds and for Paul Dano's performance, I definitely recommend it.
Did Brian Wilson himself have much involvement in the film at all, do you know?
We had a bizarre problem in our cinema in that the aspect ratio was off for the first 5 minutes, so we actually cut off all the different credits. His name does appear, so I assume that was an executive producer credit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all been done with his permission, and every end credits show him doing a live performance of his song Love and Mercy, so he has had involvement in this.
Yeah. That's good, good. Well, that's Love and Mercy. Do try and see it, I think. By the sounds of Chris's review there, it's worth seeing it. I bloody love Elizabeth Banks, so I'll definitely try and see it if it does come around my neck of the woods. It will be in cinemas, probably your art houses and your maybe your big-ass movieplexes in the cities for the next few weeks, and hopefully we'll see it put a dent into the box office top 10 when we get to that one in a few weeks' time. As has been said already in previous podcasts, we've changed the format slightly, so that we only do a couple of reviews and we each host do a different feature. My feature is the Hall of Fame, where we insert actors, actresses, directors, etc., that have never won an Academy Award but may well have been nominated or part of a nominated picture in the past. We did the Men last week. And that all that information will be on the website and the Facebook shortly. But this week we are going to be inducting the females. We've each chosen two options. Our first option will go straight in to the Hall of Fame. And the second one will basically be choosing from. We'll choose one of them. So there'll be four places up to grabs in all. I'll kick us off. This is slightly a biased one, maybe. I'm sure not everyone will agree with putting her in there, but Scarlett Johansson goes in for me. Specifically, she was they won. I think did they win or they nominated for Lost in Translation. She was never nominated personally, but the film did win the Oscar back in the early it was about 2003. I think that one came out. So she goes straight in for me. Chris, who's your first choice?
I think I'll go for an old school one, really. But it turns out that Judy Garland never really got an Oscar, which is a bit of a strange one. They sort of gave her a commemorative lifetime one that doesn't mean anything towards the end. But, you know, yeah, I think alone for promising Wizard of Oz, you know, she's fantastic, and obviously for such a young age. So, yeah, there you go.
I think women was a lot harder. I was going through, and there were so many that I thought had, you know, might not have won one. Actually, you know, did, you know, your likes of your Susan Sarandon's and stuff. I thought, oh, maybe they'd have been nominated, but they might not have won. And actually, there's a fair few women. I think there's more women tend to win, I believe, than the men. There's some of the we had a whole list of men who haven't won an Academy Award. It seems like the men seem to win more frequently, as it were, whereas the women share it out a little bit more. Because my other choice would have been Julianne Moore, but obviously she won earlier on this year. Les, I know you're not a fan of the Oscars.
No, I am not.
So for you, this must be like pulling your eyes out.
Yes, it is. I think the reason why is quite simply because when you do kind of start looking at the list of people that haven't won the award, I find myself getting more and more annoyed because you then look at the list of people who have been nominated. You're like, oh wow, okay. But also, it's, you know, just more about backslapping than anything else. But for me, my first pick, and I had to do some quick research before I started recording, and there was a really decent list on the IMDb of about 50 actresses. Right. So I had a kind of short list of five of my favourite. I think the first one I'm going to pick will be Deborah Kerr, who I really enjoy in The Innocents, but I really, really love her in Black Narcissus. Mm-hmm. And that's something that should have, that, you know, I wish she would have got some sort of nomination for something like that. I think she's a great actress, and it's one of these English actresses that, you know, that we don't really talk about that much anymore. So,
Do you know what she was nominated for?
She had six nominations.
Wow.
She had 6 nominations. She had The Sundowners. She had Separate Tables. She had Heaven Knows Mr. Allison. Mm-hmm. She had The King and I, From Here to Eternity, mm-hmm. and Edward, My Son.
King and I is probably the one I probably remember her from most, actually. So the second nominations, as I said, they're not all going in. We've then got a pick from the three that we've got chosen. My pick to go forward, again, it's a slightly biased choice again, and it's not quite as educated as what you've done. I've just gone, who do I like in movies at the moment? So my pick was Emma Stone. I believe she was nominated for The Help. Or it might have been Birdman. Which obviously she was nominated for earlier this year. But I would have probably given it for The Help as well, so there we go. Chris?
A bit of a random one there. I'd probably nominate Emma Thurman for Pulp Fiction. Or Batman and Robin, whichever one you want.
Maybe not Batman and Robin.
Which is amazing in Batman and Robin. What you want?
unless yours.
I'm gonna go for someone a bit more modern as well. I'm gonna go for Amy Adams, who hasn't won. She's been nominated Best Actress for American Hustle. June Bug was Best Supporting Actress. Doubt was Best Supporting Actress. The Fighter, Best Supporting Actress. And but the one I would have loved to have seen her win something for would have been The Master, which mm-hmm. was Best Supporting Actress as well. She's one of those people that I forget how many movies I've actually seen her in and how many times I actually really enjoyed her in.
Yeah.
And then she's in Punch Drunk. Not Punch Drunk Love. She's with Paul Thomas Anderson. So therefore, I believe that anything that guy makes deserves awards of some kind. But that's just me. So that's who I've picked.
I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship with Amy Adams because I'll see her in some stuff, The Master being one example, and I'm like, oh, she's fantastic. And then I'll see her in something like Man of Steel, which, to be fair, she can't help. And I'm just like, damn, you're not that good. And then I'm like, and then I'll watch her in something else. And I'll be like, oh, no, there we go. She's good again now. So, she's not someone that, for example, if I see her name on the credit, I'll automatically go and watch it. As I potentially would with, for example, Emma Stone. If I see her name on a credit, I'll watch it, even if it's dog crap. Even if it's Amazing Spider-Man.
Well, I think the thing is with someone like with so many actors, like you said there, you see her in one thing, you hate her, see her in something else, and you don't.
Mm.
I think it shows what the power of a set of certain directors can do. It still doesn't, it still doesn't explain Jai Courtney.
No.
But
I don't think he's ever going to be good, if I'm honest. But then you've got Suicide Squad, which I'll be willing to give him a chance. Like, if he can pull that off, then, maybe I'll change my mind. So the three nominations are Emma Stone, Uma Thurman, and Amy Adams. So the way we're going to decide it is just go one by one. You can't vote for your own, so you've got to pick someone else. And hopefully we won't all just pick different persons. Otherwise, that totally screws up the system and we'll have to vote again. So
it was Amy Adams, Emma Stone, and the last one, I guess.
Uma Thurman.
Okay.
And I'm probably going to give my vote to Uma. Chris?
Emma Stone.
And you've got the sliding vote.
I would go with Uma.
So Uma Thurman joins Judy Garland, Deborah Kerr, and who did I pick? Scarlett Johansson. There we go. So those will go up on the website and will join the men, who include Leonardo DiCaprio, and I believe Mark Wahlberg was one of the other ones as well. I'll have to refresh my mind of that list. I can't remember exactly who we inducted into the Hall of Fame. That feature will be back probably in a couple of weeks' time. I think I'm back on the show. So we'll be doing directors next time. So that one will be an interesting one, I think, because you've not got perhaps as many to pick from as you do with actors and actresses. Before we sign off, give you your opportunity to plug yourselves again. Chris?
Yeah, sure. I've got a website, filmscratches.com, which I change every week for some reason, with film reviews and such on there. So check it out. And you can follow me on Twitter at Chris M. E. Wilson.
And Les?
Yes, you can find me at afrofilmviewer.com, where I write poorly, grammatically terrible reviews and articles. I really do need a proofreader.
I thought you were going to say porn at first.
Me too.
I write porn.
No, that is my other secret website and Tumblr. It's always Tumblr. And you can find me on Twitter as well at AfroFilmViewer. And even though I'm guessing listeners have probably listened to me now and they're probably gritting my teeth at my opinion, I am quite nice on Twitter. So
this is Facebook where it's horrible. And you can find me at Dan Thomas Taylor on Twitter, and obviously you can see some of my articles and reviews on our brand new website, which I'm thinking will probably be blackholeonline.com or .co.uk possibly, but at the moment it's on WordPress, so it's .wordpress.com.
I can't wait to write for that.
Yeah, you have. what are you going to write for us?
I don't know as of yet. I've had one or two things that have kind of come up that I want to have a look at, but I think what I may find myself doing is more older stuff and just something a bit more out there and weird, whatever it takes me. I usually ramble more than anything else. So
very cool. Well, Emma's Dead Meat series, as it were, which is a regular feature on her, when she hosts, she's also writing them up and popping them on the website as well, so you can read those. She'll be back again next week reviewing Ant-Man, as well as bringing back her Dead Meat feature. So until then, make sure you follow us on Twitter and check out our website. Thank you for joining us, guys, and we'll see you all next week.